regional liaison for Southwest Ohio. And before we introduce our panel today, I just wanted to let you guys know that we have agendas at every table, and we also have a sign-in sheet going around, so please feel free to look at the agenda and please sign in so that we know you're here. So first, I'd like to thank everyone for attending. I hope you guys all had a wonderful lunch, and I would like to introduce our esteemed panel today. First, we have Mr. Don McTighe. He is an attorney with McTighe and McGinnis, LLC. Next, we have Ms. Catherine Terser. She's a director of Ohio Citizen Actions Money in Politics Project. And then we have Mr. Kurt Mayhew, who is the campaign finance administrator for the Ohio Secretary of State's office. And then we also have Mr. Tim Burke, who is a member for Hamilton County Board of Elections. And so first, the first part of the segment that we want to cover today in the campaign finance enforcement is voter ID requirements. And I just wanted to also let you guys know that it's a very relaxed environment. So if anyone has any questions, concerns, or wants to bring up any of their experiences during the campaign seasons, please feel free to raise your hand, and we'll be sure to listen to your concerns.
You said voter ID.
Which confused us.
I'm sorry.
For the record, I'm against...
Reporting. No, for campaign finance enforcement. Okay. I'm sorry about that. The first section will be reporting periods. I'd like to first ask the question. Currently, Ohio reporting deadlines are a hodgepodge of regulations that can be very difficult to navigate. So should Ohio go to the standard of monthly filing deadlines for all accounts? And also, should the period be every month for campaign accounts where the person is not on the ballot? And if we could first please start with Mr. Don McTighe for your comments, please.
I would say no. And I think part of the reason for that is my inclination right now, which will probably come up on maybe some other things as well, is that we should stop passing new laws and making changes for a while in campaign finance. So I don't see a reason, I think people, to change the filing deadlines. I think people are pretty much used to the filing deadlines. If you just start increasing the number of deadlines, you make it, I think, harder for people to be a candidate, because so much of campaign finance is essentially creating obstacles or things that candidates have to worry about that are going to, if they mess up, it's going to get blown out of proportion, and it really ultimately then doesn't serve the public interest. So on the whole, in terms of any legislative changes, I think if you're going to make any legislative changes, it ought to be for something really important right now. Otherwise, you know, I think it's time to stop tinkering for a while.
Ms. Terser?
Yeah, I don't agree with that. how can I put this? When I think about campaign finance enforcement or campaign finance regulations, I think of it like speeding. You know, a lot of people are going to speed, but you need to have some kind of mechanism, some kind of enforcement, and you need something fairly simple. You need to know whether you need to go 65, you need to know whether you can go 55, or whether you need to go 25. It just needs to be really clear. And I think you're served with two different purposes if you actually have more frequent filings. And I realize one of the problems, of course, which you alluded to, was you don't want to discourage people from being candidates. But let's think about this. We are in a time period where people are making very important budgetary decisions, and we will not have a campaign finance filing until after this is all over. So the question can be, this can be about disclosure, and it can also be about, hey, let's simplify and make it a little bit easier. So I am actually more for having more frequent filings, you know, and I would say, you know, we can have a debate about what's more frequent, but the money that comes during this off-election time period is the money that follows the winner. It's not necessarily about getting that candidate elected. So I'm definitely in favor of simplification and more disclosure.
You need? Mr. Mayhew?
I should have went before Catherine because she stole my word, which is simplification. And it's something that I've advocated for a long time, and I would agree with Don that campaign finance reform legislation for the sake of legislation has not led us to a place where it's easier for candidates to navigate the statute, it's easier for them to understand what's going to be expected of them. So with regard to reporting periods, again, simplifying the process I think would have the biggest impact. Give you an example. For a candidate running for election, a pre-election report may not be required based upon the amount of money raised or spent. When we do training, the last several years that I've been doing training, I've explained to folks that, yeah, there's a technical way to avoid filing that pre-election report, but I advocate just going ahead and filing it anyway because by the time you put in some hours to put the report together and submit it, it's no longer than if you don't file the report because your dollar thresholds are under the $1,000 and the next day's paper explains that, you know, candidate X didn't file a report. The negative seed has been sown. I mean, the true story is that the report wasn't due, perhaps, but a lot of folks don't know of the exceptions to the rules that are in effect. Also, with monthly filings of statewide candidates during an election year, the monthly filings only have to have the contributions. My recommendation would be just make them full monthly filings, you know, everything, so that everybody knows the full package, all of the contributions, expenditures, everything. And again, just making it simple for all of the filers, whether they're candidates, PACs, parties, whatever the entity may be.
Mr. Burke, please.
I agree with Don's comments. I am concerned that we have such a hodgepodge of regulations now that it really is doing more to discourage people from running from office than to encourage them. In Hamilton County, it's even worse than it is statewide because in our city council elections for Cincinnati Council, they have a different set of filing requirements and filing dates that they have to meet under the city charter, and then they have to meet our statewide filing requirements as well and file both with the clerk of council and our board of elections. It just gets crazy. I wish that there were a way to differentiate between people who were running in statewide elections or in congressional races where they were raising hundreds of thousands and perhaps millions of dollars in some races and the folks who are running for township trustee or village council or village mayor and not raising much money at all, but still enough that they have to comply with filing requirements. I certainly would not want to burden those people running in smaller races with monthly filing requirements. The bigger guys or women can afford to go out and hire a CPA and tell them to comply with the law, but somebody running for local village council isn't in a position to do that. They've got enough to do already with trying to deal with their own village council meetings and their t-ball games for their kids and all the rest of the things that they're trying to do, and we want them to be good citizens and be involved in the process, but we're throwing up barriers for them doing that.
Thank you, Mr. Burke. Any other questions or concerns from the audience?
I think they should go out and hire a lawyer, not a CPA.
Yes, Don.
Well, moving along, the next segment, we're going to be talking about routine violations. And the question we pose here is, currently, even routine violations of Ohio campaign finance law require costly and time-intensive referrals to the Ohio Elections Commission. Should routine violations, such as late filings, have automatic fines assessed by the Secretary of State's office? And if you don't mind, if we start with you again, Mr. McTighe.
Told you I made a deal with him, Don.
I would say yes. Actually, this is something that, I think I suggested this when I worked in the Secretary of State's office back in the 1980s. I think it makes sense for late filings of reports or failures to file. Those are clear violations, and you know, having a fine structure just saves a lot of time and resources for the state. I think it makes sense. I would add that I don't think that there should always be some mechanism for being able to demonstrate exceptional circumstances. Most states that have an administrative fine system also allow some out for exceptional circumstances, and I think that could be handled probably within the Secretary of State's office as well. So,
Ms. Tercer?
You know, this fits in with the idea of simplification, and when we think about campaign finance regulations or we think about enforcement, it's about encouraging good behavior, and you don't want to discourage people from running for office. So I often think you want to get at things before they get out of control. And so you really, when you think about, like, for example, your client, Senator Ray Miller, if you think about that went on and on and on for such a long period, where if it had been nipped at the bud early on, where there was like, oh, well, wait a second, you didn't file your report, let's have a conversation, you're going to be fined. What you want to do is encourage good behavior as quickly as you possibly can. It's kind of like, you know, the first time your kid puts a hand on the stove, you say, okay, this is hot, you can get burnt. You don't let them put their hand on the stove and then turn it on and then watch them get in. You create a situation where you stop things from going completely wrong. I will hand it off to you.
Notwithstanding what some folks might think, I don't enjoy sending referrals to the Elections Commission for being a day late on a filing. I think that it is an idea that we could accommodate within the office for late filings, failure to file, that sort of thing. And it would, I think, cut down on a lot of the bureaucracy between the Secretary's office and the Elections Commission. And then for folks who don't respond to the Elections Commission, ultimately the Attorney General's office seeking to collect a, you know, really large fine. So it might streamline things.
Mr. Burke?
One of the things that I tell any candidates in Hamilton County, and I'm, in addition to being on the Board of Elections, I chair the Democratic Party, so you're frequently dealing with new candidates, some people who have never done it before, some people are just thinking about it. One of the things I tell them first to do is go over and see one of the campaign finance people at the Hamilton County Board of Elections. And what we've told our campaign finance folks is your job is not to catch the candidates in making an error. Your job is to help the candidates avoid making errors and work with them. And our campaign finance people, I think, have taken that to heart and do work closely with our candidates. In spite of that, there are candidates who just won't comply because they don't think it's important to do. There are other candidates who simply haven't caught on and don't understand the importance of doing it. If there were going to be any kind of administrative fines that were automatic for late filings, I'd like to see those somehow pegged differently, again, for the small candidates than the big candidates. It makes no sense to charge that local village council member a $100 a day fine the same as you would be charging a gubernatorial candidate who's raised millions and millions of dollars. Maybe you peg the fine on the basis of contributions. I don't know. I don't know what the answer is, but I am very concerned about how we deal with those folks who are running at the local level, where we really want to encourage competition, and yet we're seeing less and less competition out there right now.
Do we have any comments from the audience, or anyone want to share any experiences on this? Yes, sir.
Bill Todd from Benish Friedlander. I'm going to address this to Kurt because I think it's a really, these two agenda items, oddly enough, seem to go together. Would there be any merit in creating a fine system that would pay for the cost of compliance instead of automatically assessing campaign filing fees, that we would take the monies from the fine system and use that to enhance the staff that Kurt has available to police the whole process.
We certainly could use the, you know, the fine structure to offset whatever our budget is GRF wise. And as in deference to, I guess, any kind of filing fee type of suggestion.
Any other comments? It's kind of following up on Mr. Burke's comments. This next question is actually on cost of compliance. Processing campaign finance filings requires experienced staff and dedicated resources. So should Ohio consider an annual filing fee along with an annual renewal of accounts, thus allowing enhanced review of campaign finance filings? What are the pros and cons of such a process? And Mr. Burke, if you'd like to start off with this, with your comments.
I'm still concerned about the little guys.
If you want to discuss what needs to happen with candidates who are running for the state legislature, the United States Congress, statewide office, and maybe some others, again, that's one thing. But we're already pushing our luck with folks who are running for local office in the smaller communities. And I don't think, particularly given where we are in this economy, that it's going to help the democratic process by throwing additional charges on them. It's also not clear to me at what level we're talking about enforcement and who is doing that, whether it's the Secretary of State's office through Kurt, whether it's the Ohio Elections Commission, and what the role then is of the county boards of elections and our responsibilities at that local level. All of that would have to be made very clear, but I'll come back to what Don said right in the beginning. At some point, we've got to leave our laws in place long enough so that people can learn what they are and comply with them instead of changing them every time somebody in the legislature thinks they have a phrase that will enhance the legislation.
Mr. Mayhew?
I going back to something Mr. Burke mentioned, it has always been, as long as I've been in the office, that the posture of our enforcement activity has always been with an eye towards helping candidates navigate something that's very, very complex, too complex, frankly, and something that is so complex that we, you know, I can tell you of phone calls that I've had with potential candidates. You know, I can think of a plumber that called, wanted to run for township trustee.
Was his name Joe?
No, it was not. It was not. It was from Southern Ohio, but that's okay.
This was a licensed plumber.
Yeah, it could have been. But his only question to me was not, you know, did I get the right petitions from the board's office, or is it true I have to get 50 signatures, or whatever that is. But he said, you know, they gave me this book, and it's campaign finance stuff, and he said, I was just going to spend some of my own money, but am I going to have to know all this stuff? And I said, you know, not all of it, but for the most part, yeah. I mean, you're going to have to read it or find someone who will take care of it for you. And he just decided right then he wasn't going to run for office because he saw that as such a deterrent, perhaps out of fear, that he didn't see it as worthwhile to go ahead and try to get involved in the process, which I think is the opposite of what we want out of the compliance statutes. So again, I think most boards of elections are oriented in such a way that they look at campaign finance not from a gotcha opportunity, but from a how can I help you take care of this very important part of your campaign, but not try to, you know, delve into the minutiae of it all and find an undotted I or an uncrossed T, but rather help you comply with the statute. I really think that the bulk of the campaign finance statutes and all the exceptions to every rule and exceptions to those exceptions that have grown over the years have just made it just very difficult for folks to get their mind around what really should be a simple process. You take money in, you spend it on things to help you get elected. It's really simple. But you have this statute that has all these different minds throughout it, and any one of them could just wreak havoc for you personally or for your campaign. So I don't think that a filing fee that is universal across all offices sought or funding levels, and perhaps the best way to do that is by the office the person is seeking election to, would be as good as perhaps using monies from minor violations in lieu of those filing fees. Because I don't want to penalize the folks who are filing on time and, you know, they have to pay a $25 filing fee every report deadline. I don't think that that is as much of a motivator as having automatic fines assessed if you miss it by a day.
Thank you, Mr. Mayhew. Ms. Tercer?
Oh, and you know, and I really would say that you're absolutely right. We need to be thinking about this depending on which of the offices the candidate is running for. And of course, the last thing that we want to do is discourage good people from running for office. So we need to really think about that as we think about any type of filing fees, or for that matter, we think about any type of enforcement. But as we think about this, we shouldn't just be thinking about, a fee, for example, on the candidates, but the political party committees that raise money could also provide a little bit of extra money to help with enforcement, and for that matter, the political action committees, and that would be a way to do this and get a bigger pool of money so that you'd have a little bit more help with enforcement. And the other thing is, Bill Todd was up here a little bit earlier, and he had an idea on a soft cost-saving measure that I thought was interesting. We visited on Monday, which was the whole idea of what about using, pooling the resources of, for example, the Ethics Commission and the Elections Commission and have them work together as a staff together. So there are those kinds of ideas, and we're in an era where we need to really be thinking about ways to save money, ways to pay for these things, and I'd encourage us all to kind of think outside the box.
So the question is whether or not candidates, PACs, political parties should be asked or be required to pay a fee in connection with filing their reports, either an annual fee or a per report fee, whatever. The answer to that, I think, is absolutely not. And the reason is this. Every campaign finance law, including simply just filing reports, is actually a restriction of our basic core First Amendment rights. And now, that doesn't mean that the government is not allowed to restrict our First Amendment rights, but there have to be a compelling governmental interest for restricting your rights, including forced disclosure of who you associate with politically, meaning who your supporters are. And there is a compelling governmental reason to force that disclosure. But now you want to make me pay for the privilege of having my First Amendment rights restricted by making me pay a filing fee in addition to the disclosure. I just, I'm not exactly a libertarian, but I think that that's going too far. These must be the libertarians. Okay.
Sir?
Don Hollister, a board member in Greene County Board of Elections. I would oppose the idea of fees in general. I don't think even a filing fee should be needed for that is filing to be a candidate. But specifically to campaign finance, I see the purpose of the reporting is for public information, and it's not the issue is not so much that this is a good boy or a bad boy. That is, we want the information out. And I'm not against fines, But in general, the purpose is get the information out, and then if, you know, where, by having the information, where there are limits to levels of contribution, that can be enforced too. But that's a whole other set of arguments. Let's maximize the public information, and let's make it simple. And my first reaction to the story about the township trustee potential, the plumber candidate, was, well, if he's going to be a good trustee, he ought to be able to read the book. But then I thought, that's not for me to decide. He should be on the ballot, then I decide. But that was a good example. A lot of people are intimidated, and more having someone who has been a campaign treasurer before or has been to one of the Secretary of State trainings that is a specialized volunteer is a valuable commodity. And in our county, we try to have a stable of available campaign treasurers to encourage people for school board, township trustee to run.
Except on having trapped a volunteer into doing it once, it's increasingly difficult to get them to do that a second time.
Any other comments on that? Sir?
I'm William McDowell, and I'm with the Libertarian Party of Ohio. And the exact position that I hold in the Libertarian Party is I'm the chairman of the Candidates and Campaigns Committee. And what that is exactly is when somebody decides that they would like to run for local, municipal level elected office, I sort of guide them along and nurture them along this process of getting their signatures and fulfilling these requirements. Because we're the type of organization that we mainly focus on smaller races, township trustee, city council, we have people that have already declared and are running for city council in Lorraine and Marion. And they are in a position where in some of these smaller communities, we can run very plausible, excellent chance of winning campaigns on just a couple $1,000s. Now, when it comes to formulating a fee for filing at the end, really, it's I can't speak to whether that would deter other third-party people from participating in these elections, but I'm very encouraged by what Mr. Burke says, and his opinion of this is spot on, specifically with libertarians, and I can imagine other third-party candidates or third parties. But one thing that does concern me a little bit was the idea was being floated around by placing a certain what sounds to me like a participation fee for parties and political action committees. Well, third parties in the state of Ohio sometimes walk this gray area of whether they are minor political parties, which the libertarians are, versus somebody who might be a political action committee, where some of the less popular third parties might be. They may or may not be even participating in this election. You know, they might not even field one candidate in an off-year election. Like, say, for example, I don't know, the Constitution Party might not even have anybody running this year. I'm sure they do, but let's pretend they don't. You're asking them to, this proposal or the one of the ideas was to ask them to file a certain fee and not actually even have anybody participating in the election. So these are things that, you know, that is concerning. I know that as a libertarian and the experiences that we've had with the Secretary of State's office in the past, we've had to use, litigation to get where we need to be, to participate. And, certainly we're certainly hoping to avoid that in the future. But this sounds a little bit sometimes like a participation fee to us. So thank you.
Thank you, sir. Any comments from the panel?
What about Bill?
Sir.
Bill Buckle, Columbus, Ohio. And I'm a treasurer of a political action committee called Taxpayers for Interest-Free Financing. We're in limbo. We've already spoke out. We watched the debt bubble go up. Now it's going down. We're still out there, but we're not doing much. And I have to file two reports. Now my first question is, what is the cost to the taxpayer for supporting all these reports and checking them out and tracking them down and so forth? Does anybody have a statewide compilation on how much it's costing us?
Mr. Mayhew?
I would probably be the one that would everyone's okay. looking at for an answer. I don't know. I mean, I as far as a, you know, a per entity cost.
Per year or something?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what the breakdown would be in terms of
including per, the counties in your own office.
Yeah, because because some PACs, you know, file with the county.
In my case. Well, the next question is not particularly useful, but I'll pose it anyway. What is the cost benefit of these things? The question is there for philosophical reasons. But I'm wondering if I get my money's worth. That's all.
Thank you, sir.
Well, I'd like to think that you do get your money's worth in terms of what the process that we go through and are expected to go through, you know, to ensure compliance with the statute. Look at the reporting and hold folks accountable to, you know, the limitations, the prohibitions, and disclosure.
I guess I misframed the paradigm. If we didn't have campaign finance reports, period, we'd have a certain, I presume, a negative. If we have them, I presume we're getting a positive out of them from the point of view of the voter and the taxpayer. That's why I asked the value versus cost question. I'd be perfectly happy to have each candidate sign, I have not accepted money from outside my political subdivision, sign off and forget about it, because then if it turns out the person's a crook, we'll catch him, throw him in jail, and avoid all this hassle. That's my reason.
I think probably the biggest benefit to disclosure is the fact that in our office, the data that we get is available online. Folks can look at the data and draw their own conclusions based on the data that's in there.
But you're calling that a benefit, not just a minor blip in the total process. It doesn't amount to hell of beans. What are we paying for? Again, I'm back to the same question. Thank you.
Can I? Well, it's funny because I spend a lot of time thinking about disclosure. Now, we can always start with, you know, there of course is the nosiness factor. Like, it's good. It's just kind of interesting to know. So that there's that part of things. But when it comes to disclosure, it allows us to look and see, for example, if the chairman of a committee is receiving significant support, for example, from all the people that he is regulating. That's important to know. It's, you know, some of it is just connecting the dots, but it's worth saying, okay, well, wait a second. Who are the people who are supporting these campaigns? And does that play a role in public policy? Now, another way to look at this is, for example, a lot of you will know about the Caperton versus Massey, which just went to the Supreme Court, meaning the U.S. Supreme Court. It's important for me to know, for example, our justices, our judges receive campaign contributions. I am very interested in who gives them money, because I'm very interested in which cases they hear. So, and we can all as voters make determination of what that means, but that's important for us to be able to have that conversation. The other thing is, it's also important at some point for us to be able to get at corruption. Now, hopefully, mostly that's not our issue. Mostly it's just like, okay, let's connect the dots. Is something going on? You know, just to have the conversation, is this affecting public policy? But sometimes it's also about getting down to the nitty gritty and actual corruption. So I would see good disclosure and openness as a big good. Now, it's also good to balance the budget of the state of Ohio, so we need to do this in a really careful way. And I actually like the fact that the next one is about brainstorming, because I think I feel like I don't have all the answers or in many ways any of the answers, and I appreciate the ability to have this kind of conversation. Anybody else about the good of disclosure?
I do want to react to that, because I find myself very much in agreement with what Catherine just said. As much as campaign reports may be a real headache and may in fact discourage some candidates, there is a very real benefit there. And I suspect any of us who have been involved in elections over a period of time have seen examples where campaign finance reports can really help voters understand who is funding particular candidates and assist voters in predicting how that candidate is going to react on certain types of issues if they are in fact elected. And to that extent, there is a real benefit. The other real benefit that's there is for the candidates who coming after them to find out who gives money politically, and they can go after. That's that you all know that that is a real purpose for which these campaign finance reports are used. But the fact of the matter is, Catherine, I think, is right, that there are times when campaign finance reports, contribution reports in particular, can really help evaluate how a candidate is likely to perform if they are in fact elected.
Thank you, Mr. Burke.
Let me point out the flip side of the benefit. To the extent that you know which special interests are giving to an office holder, and then you want to make certain assumptions, you know, true or untrue about how that office holder votes or about a contract that's awarded, that's fine. But the flip side of that is that if I support the candidate of my choice, who's not, say, the incumbent, and my name is on that candidate's report, I could be penalized by the incumbent, okay, for supporting the candidate of my choice. So disclosure has hurt me. Okay? That's the flip side.
Thank you, sir.
Yes, my name is Mike Johnson, and I have a lot of titles that deal with campaign finance. I'm the treasurer of the Libertarian Party of Ohio. I'm also the treasurer for the Franklin County Libertarian Party. I'm running for the State General Assembly, and the LPO is involved with the FEC, so as you can imagine, I probably live campaign finance about as much as you do, Kurt. I know we've had some conversations about that. And I do understand the compelling state interest in the need for the campaign finance, the disclosure, track the money, and that part I don't have a problem with. I would say that fees for filing campaign finance paperwork would definitely discourage people, individuals who want to run for office at any level. It would discourage organizations from forming at the county level, at the state level. I would be against fees, as Don McTighe said, pay to have your First Amendment rights abridged. That's not something that I would hope we would be recommending. As for the frequency of filing, this year I will be filing 22 campaign finance reports at various levels of government, with the state, county, and the FEC. Please don't make me do any more. They're not hard, they're not difficult, but it is still time consuming, and the frequency does have an impact on the people that you're asking to do this. Every report has a cover page, so you are increasing the paperwork. You know, the total number of transactions might be the same, but you will be increasing paperwork. There will be more for you to have to do, more for you to look over if you increase the frequencies. And you know, leaving things the way they are for a little bit might let people get used to it and help increase your compliance. And as to what Mr. Burke said, that different reports require different things, I believe that was you early on, each campaign finance report should require the same things: contributions, expenditures, loan updates, that sort of thing. Different reports at different times for different people should not include different information. It just makes the whole process more confusing. I'll pause there if you guys want to respond to any of this. Okay. I've been taking notes, so. And if you do institute sort of the fines that we talked about, something maybe proportional to the size of the organization, a county or a state level organization, and the actual size of the organization, the Libertarian Party of Ohio is a small organization. even though we are statewide, we definitely do not have the money that the Ohio Republican and Democratic parties do. I've looked. I wish we had those numbers. We just don't. You know, if a fine at a state level organization is $10,000, you're killing your competition with the fine. I mean, that's something that has to be considered. You will effectively remove competition from the political process with an administrative fine. And that probably wouldn't look good. And I would also suggest start with warnings for first-time or infrequent offenders. If someone, especially running at local office, misses one campaign finance report, just call them and tell them about it, send them a letter. You probably don't need to start with a fine.
Thank you, sir. Any comments?
You know, I'm a registered lobbyist, and we pay a fee to do this, and I live in fear of not actually getting an accurate and spend my time worrying. And so I do as we think about how we're going to pay for things, and we think about the cost of enforcement, I think we do need to weigh exactly what you were talking about, and maybe, you know, if we come to the point where fees make good sense to us, you know, a lower fee, but it's worth having a conversation about, you know, how are we going to pay for this, which is also a good libertarian value.
Thank you.
My name is Jim Milliken, and I'm from Jackson County, a very rural county in southeastern Ohio, so I agree with a lot about Mr. Burke. I mean, we have people come in running for township trustee or council, and they get that deer in the headlight look when you start giving them all these papers and please sign for them. Is there any possibility of maybe increasing on these, you know, you can do a township trustee, can do a waiver. Is there any possibility of increasing that number there where, you know, the $100 per person and the $1,000? Is there any possibility of increasing that?
Mr. Mahey?
I'll take a stab at it. I think that could easily be increased to make it meaningful in terms of both the full campaign dollar amount, which is $2,000. That could easily be, I mean, you know, statewide contribution limits are 11,000 now. You know, even if you
plus
make it
change.
What's that?
I said plus change.
Yeah, that's right. So that could be increased. I mean, that's not, unlike contribution limits, that's not indexed for inflation or anything. So that's been around since, you know, 99, I think, or so. The $100 cap could go up. I mean, all of that can be revised to make the local candidate waiver actually mean something. As opposed to now, you know, you're stuck with $2,000 and $100 per person. I would go so far as to say remove the $100 and increase the total amount that a trustee or somebody could operate under and not have to disclose.
One of the I think we're probably in number four by now on brainstorming.
It's a good thing.
But I think in terms of one change that might be useful is, and this has always kind of bothered me, is, you know, Ohio has this exemption on you don't have to itemize contributions of $25 or less at a fundraising event. But if I give you a penny, you know, for your campaign and it's not in connection with a fundraising event, you have to list me on your report. Now, this was put in the law at a time when almost all money was raised at fundraising events, okay? I mean, you didn't have direct mail and it's certainly not internet, that sort of thing. But I think for equal protection law reasons alone, we have to have one rule across the board. And my suggestion would be to probably up the $25 to either $50 or $100 and say there's a $100 threshold. Anybody who gives you $100 or less, you don't have to itemize. Only when they go over 100 do you have to itemize. The federal rule is 200. Only when the aggregate contributions for an election from a person goes over 200 do you have to actually list that person's name. You don't even have to keep a record of anybody who gives you $50 or less. Okay, so I could give you $50 in cash, and you don't have to even ask my name, okay? So, of course, you want to because you want to ask me for more later. But I think Ohio law needs to up the threshold and apply it across the board. And I think that would help reduce a lot of the paperwork burden, especially on the smaller candidates.
I would worry, this is my worry. I do these campaign finance studies where I look at, how much is coming, for example, from, let's take a law firm. What's your law firm? McTighe & McGinnis. Okay, so we'll take, one of the things that can happen is that all of the lawyers, we'll say the partners, associates, all will give, for example, at $108.29. Do you remember that time? Okay, or they gave $107, in total, it all added up to $10,000. And so to me, it does make sense, for example, to say $25, we don't need to know people who give less than $25. But there is serious bundling that goes on around the $100 mark that we need to know so that we can actually be able to see trends in the money. Cincinnati Insurance, which is from your neck of the woods, they give, a number of the employees, you can go through and you'll be like, okay, here's, 101, here's 125. You add it all up and you're like, good Lord, this is a lot of money. And what does this mean? And what does it mean for voters? And they should be able to do that.
Sir, I know you had a question over here.
Adam Booth, Columbiana County. This is probably more for just Kurt, but the question comes from having been a party treasurer candidate myself. We have to file our restricted interstate candidate online, and it's a really good tool. I don't know how many people here have used it, and I was just wondering if it's ever going to get to the level of the counties where, those that want to, county candidates, and even maybe down to school board trustee. I don't know that you want to go that low. But is the interface ever going to be available to the counties to not accept paper filings? But if the candidates chose to, they could also still do paper, but if the candidates chose to go online and make use of the technology that's already there at the lower levels?
It would probably require a statutory change in terms of making those offices file with our office as opposed to making it an option available, because what happens is a candidate files online and his information is immediately available to everybody in the county as opposed to his opponent who files on paper at the county, and so you have data in different places in different formats. Again, in the vein of simplification, certainly, the application that we've built and the database that we have, the structure that's in place, could accommodate more office types being filing with our office. But I think just for simplification purposes, you would have to have a statutory change saying, now, there's just centralized campaign finance filing. Everybody files at the same place. In order to make that really work or function well. But I mean, the system could handle that, yes. But you do bring up another point with parties, and that is, or I should say with just the differences in filing. I mean, even currently, candidates who run for General Assembly file on paper can file at the board, but if you raise a certain amount of money, you have to file electronically with our office, and so there's some confusion as to where's the report. If I don't get it, I can't automatically assume that they failed to file. I have to call the counties and find out.
What we do is we will at least ask them to come and still file their cover page. That way, if the media wants it, if their opponent wants it, they can see what they've raised, what they've spent without the itemized. And I guess you could go online if you knew they filed online and get the itemized. But we still ask that they at least file the cover page just for the purposes of accessibility.
Just so everybody knows where it's at.
Right.
Yeah. But also county parties, your restricted fund, only if you take corporate dollars do you have to file electronically with us. So if you don't take any corporate dollars, it's on paper at the board. So it sets up a very confusing process. So again, simplification would help.
So kind of building off the discussion that we've started on this brainstorm segment of our of campaign finance, Ms. Terser, you had mentioned the notion of critical thinking and kind of thinking outside the box. And I just kind of wanted to move on to the question of can or should Ohio revisit the contract bar for political contributions of House Bill 694? Are there ways to expedite investigations and resolve issues? And if you don't mind, if we can start with you on this topic.
Once again, you know, this is the brainstorming section because I think this is actually really hard stuff. When we were going, good Lord, this is loud. Sorry, but y'all. When we were going through 694, which was in December, poor Kurt was off almost going to on vacation. Do you remember that? And it was this lame duck thing, and you know, all of a sudden, I had children asleep in the back at the legislature because they didn't pass anything until like around 11:30 at night. So they went really quickly, and they didn't go through the kind of thoughtful process that you would really need to go through. So I actually do think they should revisit it and go through a very thoughtful process. And one of the questions that I had in that process the most was, okay, so you decide that you want to do something where you establish campaign contribution limits for the contractors. And you have these contractors and you say, okay, we are gonna affect the principals and their spouses and their children. Well, how the heck are you gonna do that unless you create a database of the principals, the spouses, and their children? And so there are all sorts of kind of ways to think about enforcement. How will this actually work? Will the Secretary of State's office have the time? When you're talking about an aggregate cap, which they established in 694, which is $2,000, well, that means that you would need to go through and Secretary of State would need to total it all up and check it all out. I mean, I just all the enforcement questions that come to mind. And I'll throw it to you as you think about this issue. I know you don't want to necessarily recommend legislation, but as you think about the enforcement part of things, it's a particularly difficult thing to think about enforcement and contractors. Basically, what 694 did, it is establish aggregate limits for the principals who want a contract with the state of Ohio. And so that would mean, like, if you and I had a company, for example, a cleaning service, and we wanted to get a cleaning service contract with the Secretary of State's office, okay, we would put in our bid, but you and I, and we'll say you're married and you have six children, and I'm married and I have three, altogether, we couldn't give more than $2,000. But how in the world does the Secretary of State's office manage to work this through in terms of the money that goes to the person that awards the contract, unless you have this other database? There'd be time spent looking this over and paying attention to it. It's an enforcement nightmare. The other thing that's interesting about this is, okay, let's suppose we wanted to influence this process. And we wanted to get the contract from the Secretary of State's office, right? But we decided we would not give anything to the Secretary of State, but we gave everything to the Democratic Party. Did I hear? Those are the kind of shenanigans. So what about the fact that you don't know in the database of the Secretary of State's database whether that person is a contractor? Because then it would permit you to look and say, okay, well, they're meeting the requirements of 694, which restricts us all giving the $2,000. But look, we found a way around the process. It wouldn't allow us to actually figure that out. So does that explain it very well? All right. Yeah, and I'll throw it to Kurt.
Well, for what it's worth, I'm very pleased with the ruling so far in the 694 litigation, because you know, it would pretty much revert it back to the way it was before, which was much more manageable. Under 694, it's true. In order to really enforce 694, I'd have to have a data set of all the contracts, and there's some dispute as to, you know, what's a contract for 694. I mean, let's just start at the basics. But also a database of partners, 20% shareholders in corporations, their spouses, their children. I mean, I don't want that kind of information, and I think it was a hastily put together piece of legislation that, you know, the big picture was to try to tighten down the pay-to-play allegations that were out there, but it really made it very unmanageable in terms of 694 by itself. The contract bar before was relatively simple. It was easy to apply. It applied only to unbid contract work. So if you went through the bid process, it didn't, you know, those contributions didn't apply. I mean, that's a pretty rigorous set of rules and steps that you have to go through to get a contract if you have to go through the bid process. So I think that that would be far more reasonable to deal with.
Mr. Burke?
Don and I, in the interest of full disclosure, are both involved in litigating the legality of 694, both on the same side, challenging its legality. The status of that litigation is that we prevailed at the common pleas court level here in Hamilton, in Franklin County. It's been argued, it was argued on October 30th?
October 1st or 2nd, I think.
Sometime last fall. And we are still awaiting the Court of Appeals decision. Catherine's right, that bill was rushed through in the closing hours of the General Assembly and rushed so quickly that the wrong version of the bill was signed by the President of the Senate and the Speaker of the House. They signed a version of the bill that had never been adopted by the two houses of the legislature. That same version of the bill was signed by Governor Taft, and they didn't discover that the right version of the bill was never signed until the administrations had all changed over. And that's part of the basis of the litigation, as is the constitutional issues that Don has raised when the legislation suggests that somebody like AFSCME that might donate to candidates can no longer have an enforceable contract for their employees with the municipality where they are making those contributions.
Mr. McTighe?
Yeah, let me add a bigger picture comment related to laws that prohibit awarding a contract if contributions by certain individuals connected with the recipient exceed a certain amount. That's what House Bill 694 complicated the process, but we had a similar law, less complicated, on the books since, I don't know, the 1970s, okay? Now, the issue is whether we should have a law at all. In my view, we should not have a law that bars the award of a contract based on the amount of contributions given by people associated with the recipient. We should not have such a law if in situations where contribution limits otherwise apply to the office holder. And the reason is this. The only constitutional justification that's been recognized by the U.S. Supreme Court for a contribution limit to any candidate or to a political party or to a PAC is to prevent corruption, in other words, the buying and selling of contracts, the buying and selling of votes, or the appearance of corruption. Now, if the legislature has determined that there is no appearance of impropriety until you go over 11,000, whatever the current number is, right?
Okay.
Then how can there be corruption because I gave more than $1,000 and got a contract? They've already said that corruption doesn't kick in for purposes of contributions until you go over a certain amount, which is this, what they've said it at $11,000. Why is there a double, why is there all of a sudden a lower corruption threshold for people who get contracts? It doesn't make constitutional sense, okay? And that would take care of eliminating a lot of the problems, that administrative problems with the law.
So, Don, are you actually suggesting that we lower all the limits?
Well, my view is that we shouldn't have contribution limits at all,
okay.
And then we should have a limit with regard to the award of public contracts. That's why I said, with regard to the people where there are otherwise contribution limits, you shouldn't have such a law. But I think that contribution limits, by and large, are fairly easy to, you know, not avoid the limit, because you can't really avoid the limit without breaking the law, but it's very easy to still raise as much money, and you're not going to be hampered in the end. And it doesn't ultimately serve the purpose that the contribution limit law is there to serve, which is to prevent certain people from having undue influence. Those people simply go out and raise money from other people.
Thank you, Mr. McTighe. We have a question over here.
Bill Todd with a question. Two quick comments in 694. One is that the point of, as you all know, the point of the aggregate limits is to deal precisely with the issue that Catherine Tercer has raised, and that is bundling of contributions. Mm-hmm. What we saw are giant law firms with 500 partners each putting in $10,000 in order to get big contracts from the state of Ohio, particularly the Attorney General's office. That's what that was supposed to be aimed at. The second thing is I disagree with Mr. McTighe's analysis of the contributions versus earmarks or specific contracts. That is precisely the targeted zone of quid pro quo corruption, which does give us a compelling state interest in order to regulate. But my question is this. Given the scandal in Attorney General Dan's office last year, and given the current issues that have arisen with Senator Miller, do we need a clear, bright line between campaign contributions and campaign accounts and their use by candidates and their friends for personal living expenses? Yes.
Thank you, sir.
My answer to that would be yes, of course. You know, when we think about the, you know, think about someone giving a campaign contribution and, you know, they give their 50 or their 100 bucks, you know, because they really support this candidate, and to have it just be used for whatever, you know, I was very surprised. Channel 10 did this thing. It would have been in you know, early fall of last year, where they had on tape Jay Hottinger saying that he used, you know, he used campaign cash to buy football tickets, and that generally he was using them, you know, to give to funders, which is inappropriate, you know. Possibly appropriate use. Kirk can tell you more about that. But then saying, but lots of times I go by myself with my family. But you know what? When I'm there, I talk a lot about the work that needs to be done with the state. At the same time, you know, because I don't want to pick on just one side of the aisle, I'll pick on the other. Sorry, libertarians, left and right. Sorry. You know, we have Bob Hagan who you know is dancing and showing his tuxedo that he used campaign cash to rent, and I think, oh my God, we need a bright line test.
I think you good. Bought it.
Did you find
it? I think
you
bought it.
Okay, he bought it.
Whatever.
I would add to that, you know, much has been made about, you know, OSU football tickets and things like that, but really, I think that the primary issue is not what is purchased, but how it is used.
Yes.
You know, we see folks spend a ton of money on postage, but we presume that it was used for a legitimate purpose, which is appropriate. It's the misuse of those campaign assets that becomes the problem. Now, I, you know, until the legislature does put in some sort of clearer language in terms of what is personal. It's kind of difficult to identify those things, and I'm not necessarily in favor of legislating specific issues, because then you just, you know, work around them if your intention is to misuse the funds in the first place. So, by and large, candidates, in my judgment, candidates, campaign committees are very much want to abide by the rules, abide by the restrictions placed on them. They function properly. The biggest problem seems to be just understanding exactly what is expected of me in this disclosure and record-keeping process.
Thank you, Mr. Mayhew. Any other comments from the panel? Sir?
Mike Johnson from the Libertarian Party of Ohio. Just on the topic of contribution limits, you know, as I alluded to before, we don't have a lot of money. We're not in a situation where we're running into people trying to give us more money. I wish we were, but we're not. But I would still say that I would agree with Don McTighe. Why do we need contribution limits? Catherine gave a perfect example on how to get around them. People do that all the time already. That's part of what leads to the vitriol that's been in our recent campaigns. People give money to attack groups that do things that candidates would not do. The public says they don't like those kind of ads, and then the legislature implements campaign finance limits that actually promote them through a perversion of the system. And, you know, no one's gonna be coming to my door with a $50,000 check tomorrow, but why should they not be allowed to?
I think limits are very difficult. I do think if you actually believe if you actually believe that there should be no limits, then there has to be a lot more disclosure, much, much more filings. Well, we already heard people were not wanting more filings. So, we, you know, when we think about this whole system, we need to think about, you know, what kind of information the voters can get. The campaign contribution limits can serve a purpose, much like you were getting at contractors and, you know, kind of quid pro quo situations, also people who are regulated, kind of quid pro quo situations. So there is a reason for, there is a reason for them. But if we, for example, decided today to get rid of them, then we would need much, much, much better disclosure. And look at Illinois, no campaign contribution limits there.
Any other comments from the panel? Any other questions or concerns? Well, we just have a few more minutes left here in the panel discussion. I just wanted to open it up again to the panel for any closing remarks. And if we can start with Mr. McTighe.
Well, I think that in terms of legislation, there's probably higher priorities in the next year in making changes to election laws other than campaign finance laws. Getting back to kind of one of my opening comments there. However, I suppose if there was going to be some sort of omnibus type election bill introduced, that there could be some limited campaign finance changes made. I guess what I would say would be most useful would be raising the threshold for itemizing contributions, perhaps itemizing the threshold too for the candidates that have to file, when they have to actually file reports at the lower level offices. So I think that would be useful if there's going to be legislation. I don't think we necessarily need to have it just by itself. There is clarity that can be brought to campaign finance laws if the Secretary of State's office would exercise its power more to promulgate regulations regarding campaign finance about what is required on reports. So I think that we don't necessarily need a legislative remedy to bring clarity to everything, but some of it can be through regulation, which is, you know, regulations have the same force and effect of law. So I think that that's, you know, something else that could be looked at.
Ms. Tercer?
No, I think directives are not enforceable except with regard to boards of elections. But you're talking about creating legal liabilities, responsibilities on citizens. That has to be done through regulations. The Secretary of State's office comes up with interpretations of campaign finance law and then does audit letters and says, this is, you know, what, you know, here's the questions that we have and this is what we want you to provide to us, that sort of thing. But it's not really always required. It could be required if the Secretary of State was to enact regulations, because then you have something that's on the book. You can't just enforce something that hasn't been enacted or promulgated.
Ms. Tercer?
I'm going to go back to actually how I started, which was simplification and better disclosure is really something that should be on the agenda. If in fact we slow down this train, then say, let's not do this year, then what we should do is be preparing and thinking through simplification. All you have to do is look at the February 25th change in campaign contribution limits, and there are like 13 different exceptions to the campaign contribution limit chart, for example. So I'm going to just mention that. The other thing that I was going to say is it is my hope that this year the Secretary of State's office is actually changing and updating the database and kind of the user interface. And so that is actually something that won't happen legislatively but would make a tremendous difference. And so I'm going to head it to you.
Just when I figured out how to use it.
Thank you, Ms. Tercer. Mr. Mayhew?
I'm glad that, you know, it came up on its own, the issue of simplification, because I do think that that's what's most needed with campaign finance regulation. The difficulty with using our rulemaking authority often has been that our proposed definitions or explanations or requirements put into rules have been met with claims that we're overreaching our authority and we're attempting to legislate, and so a lot of times, you know, we'll put a rule together and perhaps we'll get over to JCAR and, you know, they think that we've gone too far. But we obviously think that the rules are reasonable and can be easily understood. But then on the other hand, you know, if you hear from the Elections Commission, they'll tell you that they have no duty to enforce our rules. So, you know, what is the point to promulgate a rule that ultimately doesn't lead to any enforcement from the Elections Commission? Now, we could, you know, modify the statute to make them adhere to or enforce our rules, but that's the current state of regulations now. So, and yes, we are making some changes to our database and our disclosure site to make the data that we do receive much more accessible and usable to the public, so they can take it and manipulate it however they want to come up to whatever conclusions they're seeking based on the data that has been submitted.
Thank you, Mr. Mayhew. Mr. Burke?
I continue to fear that in order to deal with some of the large campaign issues, like the Mark Dan question that was raised earlier, that we regulate to deal with the big races and fail to realize that while last year may have been exciting with the presidential election and important countywide and congressional races, this year we have thousands and thousands of more elections than we did last year, and they're all for little offices, and those are the places that feel the brunt of the over-regulation that occurs when you talk about what happens at that level. And I hope in simplifying the regulations that that's something that gets seriously looked at, because I know that it is becoming tougher and tougher to recruit candidates and to encourage candidates to run at that level. There are more and more local races that go without any opposition, and that's not good for what's supposed to be the greatest democracy on earth.
Thank you, Mr. Burke. I'd like to thank you all for coming out to this work group session, and if we could please take a minute to thank our panel members with a round of applause. Thank you so much. And I hope you guys enjoy your next work group session, and I wish you all a safe drive back to your home counties. Thank you.